RCR with Paul Brennan. Reality Check Radio.
All right, it's time for our political panel, a political agenda for the end of this week. I want to welcome Ro Edge, Save Women's Sports Australasia. Hi, Ro, how are you?
Good, thank you, Paul.
William McGimsey, I said you're a policy expert, but I think I might have gone a bit too far with that, William, but maybe you are an expert, and people don't like experts anymore, so maybe that was the wrong word. And RCR contributor, William, great to have you this morning.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. It's good to be here. Yeah, I used to work in the government. I was a policy wonk, so that's what that means.
Okay, so we'll change that now officially to policy wonk from here on.
I'm not sure I really like that one too much either, but it'll do.
You come up with something. Whatever you want, you know, we'll do it. And Helen Halton will join us, leader of the new Conservative Party, shortly. She's not quite with us yet. All right, I want to start off with the COVID inquiry. I've got a clip to play in just a moment, but what do you folks think about the fast release of that? William, you can go first on that. Policy wonk.
Well, I thought it was a surprise because the Minister of Internal Affairs, Brooke Van Velden, who is the minister in charge of the inquiry, had signalled earlier on that they planned to hold on to the report and not publicly release it until phase two of the inquiry was well underway. And so that would mean a release sometime early next year. But it looks like they've just released it. As soon as she got it, she made it publicly available. Perhaps that was at the urging of Tony Blakely. I'm not sure. But anyway, transparency is always a good thing. So it's up there. It's publicly available. We can all see what the phase one of the inquiry at least has said.
Yeah, something changed there, right? Maybe even last minute.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure what could have spurred that. I guess what they're worried about is, one of the things they're worried about anyway, will be whether there's contradictory advice between the two bits of the report. And so if you hold on to phase one until you've got an idea of what phase two is going to say, you can manage the messaging a bit better. Maybe that's one of the considerations. I'm not sure what else would have motivated it.
Ro, what were your thoughts the release of that yesterday?
I think it was just good to get it out there. I don't know what the rationale was for holding it back, because it just leads to more distrust, doesn't it? I mean, I think we all knew that it was going to be a generous assessment of what the government did because of the terms of reference for it. So what was there to hide with holding it back? So no good on them for releasing it.
Some have called it a whitewash, I see, and I can see why some would say that. Is it, do you think, so far what we know?
Well, did it tell us anything that we didn't already know?
Well, that's a very good point. Maybe it told people, not like us, who don't know anything, something.
The positive thing about the report is that it does give some nods towards mandates and lockdowns being overused and too stringent and causing division and taking people's rights away. Some nods. So that the basic narrative is that those measures were justified and worked well at the beginning of the pandemic. But then as time went on, there was no strategy for exiting from the elimination strategy.
Mm.
And so as a result, there was just a reliance on these measures, and that led to opposition, it led to harms, it led to social division. And that's really the criticism that's made here.
Yeah, but the way things are worded, they're still talking about the next pandemic, the next one. You know, it's the same old language, you know?
Yeah, and the responses are still going to include lockdowns, vaccines. Like, nothing seems to change there. And yeah, some things the report's completely missed out on was all the damage done to the economy and to people's trust in government. Like, you know, because the response was so over the top and our health response was so weak. I mean, you remember when the pandemic started, and we quickly knew that it was people that were obese or had two or more comorbidities were the ones that were most at risk of COVID. You know, some simple ideas on how you could improve your lifestyle with health and exercise would have been great. But, you know, even in that report, I read that in terms of recreation areas, they just said they might not lock as many of them up or, you know, stop us using as many of them. So they're still not recognising that getting out in the sun and getting fresh air is actually the best way to get through this.
Yeah, and I think the worst aspect of the report is the section on vaccines. So there's, and we knew this because it wasn't really within their terms of reference, but they've weighed in and said some things anyway. There's no acknowledgement. We were promised a vaccine that was safe and effective. There's no acknowledgement that the vaccine did not do very much to prevent transmission, and it didn't prevent people from getting seriously ill if they did contract COVID. And there's also very little mention of some of the serious side effects that people had from the vaccine. As far as this report's concerned, vaccination was a great thing, and it would have been better if we'd have vaccinated more people more quickly and more often. So,
Also said that it was effective against the Delta, but not the Omicron. So they were kind of having a bob each way.
Perhaps we can give them some credit for that. Phase two of the report is really where this question is going to be interrogated in more depth. So we can hopefully, once phase two reports back, we get some serious considerations of whether the things that were claimed about the vaccine were really true or not. Because I think we were lied to there. We were lied to at the beginning, and we were lied to as things went through. They knew some of this information about transmission not being prevented, and they pretended that... pretended that it did.
But why pretend? Because you're thinking of yourself and how you're coming across, and who cares about the people? That's what that says to me. That's so cynical. I know they do it all the time, but in this case. Oh, by the way, Helen Halton, new Conservative leader, is now with us. Hi, Helen.
Good morning, Paul. Pleasure to be here. Sorry, I was sitting on a different link.
No, I know. These things happen. We're just talking about phase one. But and also, I noticed with a lot of the comments, I've been curious to read comment responses from the likely sources. And there's still people out there, many people who think thousands, tens of thousands of lives were saved. They really believe that.
Yeah, look, I mean, all the way through, they try and justify our response that we did better than so many other countries. But like... every country made the same mistake except Sweden. And ironically, they also say that we were all prepared for a pandemic. Well, we actually had a pandemic plan already, one that Sweden followed, you know, and Sweden has got one of the best results in the world. So, yeah, I just reading the report, if we were just solely relying on this report, we've learnt nothing. And they seem to be recommending we do the same thing again. And concerningly, they talk about mis and disinformation. And I've heard... was it Helen, the vaccine lady?
Boutassis Harris.
Yes, I heard her on an interview this morning saying that we need to work out how we clamp down on that in future pandemics.
That was worrying. The stuff around misinformation was worrying. But what if you read the recommendations of the report, what it looks like they're suggesting here is something very similar to the Australian COVID Inquiry report suggested, which is a big new pandemic bureaucracy to handle these things in the future. The argument they're running is if we had a big pandemic bureaucracy and more pandemic planning and more of this sort of stuff, then we would have been more agile and smarter, and we would have been able to exit the elimination strategy more quickly, and we wouldn't have had to rely so much on the lockdowns and the mandates toward the end of the pandemic, and we could have headed those problems off. So bureaucrats come up with more bureaucracy as a solution. This is what they do all the time, and this is what they've done here.
All right, bear with. I want to play this clip because this is Heather Duplessis-Allen with Chippy, as she calls him, right through the interview. Christopher Hipkins, who fronted to some media late yesterday afternoon, early evening. We'll take a listen to this. It's a few minutes long, then we'll come back.
You had a chance to read some of this?
I've only had a chance to read this, you know, the summary report, which is about 120 pages long. I will sort of make my way through the full report in due course.
Okay. Do you think, so let me just bring you up to speed with, I think, what is the most critical part in this report? And this is around the vaccine mandates. They say the vaccine mandates went too far and the vaccine mandates were held too long. Would you agree with that?
I mean, one of the challenges with a report like this, of course, is that they're drawing on information with the benefit of hindsight. So the issue around whether the vaccine mandates went on too long draws on information that wasn't available to us when we made decisions.
No, that's not true. Time. It's information that you did have, and they're quoting cabinet papers that you had.
Well, I mean, but they're also making conclusions, like, for example, the information about whether the transmissibility of Omicron versus Delta. That information wasn't clear always at the time that we were making those decisions. But actually, in answer to your questions, to be really specific, do I think the vaccine mandates went a bit too wide? Yes, I actually accept that finding. And so, yes,
and
I do
too
accept
long?
That one.
Too long?
Too long. I haven't had a chance to read that and okay. pull that part
Look,
of the report.
Chippy,
so I do want to do that before I form
the... This is, you had a cabinet briefing on the 22nd of January 22, and it said... Vaccines show reduced effectiveness against the Omicron variant compared to Delta. So you knew in January 22 that it wasn't going to work as well and that the mandates weren't going to work as well. And yet you guys kept the mandates in place until September 22.
Well, but I mean, that's only one paragraph or one sentence out of what was quite a long and detailed briefing about
the... Yeah, but you would have read it because it had this had material effect on Kiwis' lives and jobs, right? So you would have been, when you were weighing up, as the health minister, whether to recommend the mandates, this would have been fundamental to your decision.
Of course. And actually, you know, we're weighing up a whole lot of factors at the time. None of these decisions were easy and none of them were straightforward. Every one of them involved, you know, quite a difficult set of trade-offs.
Actually, thank you for raising that, because I've been trying to figure out what the trade-off was, right? Here you guys are sitting in cabinet. You know the mandates are not going to work now that you've got Omicron, and yet you keep them in place. Why?
Well, ultimately, we were trying to make sure that as you know, COVID-19 spread in the community, that as fewer people got critically ill and as fewer people died as possible.
And, yeah, but what's the trade-off, Chippy? Because it says they say to you, it's not going to work as well. So why did you keep it?
Well, right the way through the pandemic response, there were difficult trade-offs. I mean, if you'd have taken the view that that there was no price worth paying and to be able to save someone's life, we would have made different decisions all the way along. Much of the information that's available now to look at things in hindsight wasn't information that was as readily available.
That's not true. I just quoted you information you had at the time. Chippy, listen, do you know what? I actually think you, as the health minister, owe a lot of people an apology for them losing their jobs, don't you?
Well, yeah, like I said, not all of the information was available at the time.
Yeah, but you can't use that excuse. I literally just read you something that was a cabinet briefing that you would have read. So do you not think that you owe people an apology?
Well, I want to read the report first before I make any decisions about that.
You're going to read the
urgent interview before I've read the report. I'm being as accessible to you as possible.
No,
but Chippy, read the report.
Come on. I mean, here's the thing. I've never read this cabinet briefing before. I've read it in this report, and it is clear to me you have read this cabinet briefing before. You made the decision. This is not news to you. This is stuff you already know. So you should already know whether you owe people an apology or not.
You're quoting one sentence out of a report that was written 3 years ago. So I want to read the full report before I make a conclusion on that.
If you read the report and you come to the same conclusion as I do, are you going to apologise to all of those Kiwis who lost their jobs because of a decision that you made?
Well, as I said, I mean, I think that I already accept one of the findings of the report, which was that the mandates went too far. So I've already said that, but I want to read the full report before going any further than that.
Now, listen, where's your mate Jacinda? Is she going to front up about this stuff?
I haven't spoken to her, so I don't know. You'll have to ask her that question yourself.
Okay, we will.
All right, Slick Chippy with Duplessis Allen on News Talk ZB yesterday. I thought it was kind of appropriate to play that because, well, he's doing the typical politician thing, isn't he? Helen, you can weigh in on that.
Oh, yes, thank you. He cannot bear the shame of saying, I'm sorry, we got it wrong. Now, I'm really glad you played that because out of all the commentary on the inquiry, this is what I really wanted to focus on, Hipkins. And I name him King Hipkins because I watched him last night and he had this air of superiority as he looks down on his subjects. You know, the pompous twat. His denial of any blame is so deep that he continues to polish the brass on a sinking ship. Mm. It's just appalling. So, yeah, that was my take on watching him last night. Cringe.
Roe or William, anything to say after that?
Well, I'm actually enjoying hearing the media actually try to hold him to account, finally, when they didn't bother doing that.
They wanted him to say sorry there. That was the aim.
Yeah, they did. You know, I heard his interview. He had a stand-up yesterday, and even Jenna Lynch was saying to him, well, do you think you should have actually gone out and talked to the protesters now?
Oh, okay.
I was like, really, Jenna, after all this time? But, yeah, I mean, it is interesting to hear people starting to push back. And, like, Mike Hosking yesterday morning actually mentioned that English professor.
Angus Dalgleish. We had him on ages ago.
I know. So he finally mentioned him and his verdict on Australia's COVID response, which was pretty much the same as ours, and said it was appalling, madness and disgraceful, and that the only country that got it right was Sweden. So you know, I hope that Chippy is put under some pressure. I don't know how he is still leader of Labor. I mean,
I don't know how he sleeps at night.
Completely inept. No, neither do I. Well, he said he didn't sleep much during COVID. I don't know. We shouldn't be sleeping much now. The damage that man did.
Oh, there's a nice little single bed, Stark room with a bowl in the corner waiting. William.
Yeah, well, the rationale for separating the vaccinated from the unvaccinated has to do with the vaccine preventing transmission. And what we're seeing here is that the evidence that they had was that it didn't really do that with the Omicron variant.
6 months at least in advance.
Yeah, and so, but they went ahead with it anyway. So I think one of the problems here is that politicians, especially in a case like this, they have competing imperatives, right? They have to manage the political side of things, the political narrative, to make sure their government is still popular. But they also, on the other hand, have this duty in a pandemic situation to be providing accurate information to the public. And in this case, their whole narrative that they were selling for the political management, that, oh, yes, we've got the best response in the world. We're getting everyone vaccinated. We've got these huge rates of vaccination. And we're doing it better and more quickly than everyone in the world. And that's going to prevent us from having more deaths than anyone else. And so that was the line to manage the politics and the public opinion. But it didn't match up with what the science and the advice they were telling them towards the end of the pandemic. So that's something I think for the inquiry to look at, and something for the bureaucrats to think about in future. When politicians, it's a problem when you have competing imperatives around political management and managing the messaging, but also a duty to provide accurate information to the public.
Yeah,
The one thing that he didn't want to give up, and Ardern didn't want to give up, was control. They got control, they loved that control, and they did not want to let it go, which is why they continued the appalling response that we had for so long.
The key question is, were they doing what they thought was right? How can you be when the evidence says you're probably most likely wrong? You do that, you put lives at risk potentially, but it doesn't really matter to you. You've really got to ask why. I mean, what thinking process is that?
Well, they state in the report that MedSafe and the Ministry of Health sought to keep people up to date with emerging evidence of rare complications. Yet we all know the evidence on myocarditis was held back from the public for months because they didn't want to create vaccine hesitancy. So they put like that was leading up to Christmas.
And it was him who signed off the kids.
Yep. And my daughter, I remember she was under so much pressure because she wanted to go to R&V and she was like, should I get it? And I was like, no, R&V is never going to happen for a start. But no, you should not be pressured into getting it. And I'm so glad. But, you know, they were lying to the public. And yet this report doesn't highlight that.
Well, to be fair, that report doesn't have anything about efficacy or safety of the vaccine because those issues were outside the scope of phase one.
But it does mention in there specifically that they sought to keep people up to date with emergency evidence. So,
Lies.
For something that was outside scope, I thought they talked too much about it and they talked too favourably about the vaccination as a policy tool.
Hmm. That might have something to do with Blakely and his background, maybe. I don't know. Because he was all in, wasn't he? Seems. All right, anything more to say about this particular matter before we move on?
Looking forward to phase two. As I understand, consultation opens on it today, so like everyone should have their say.
All right, on to this. Kids to be banned from social media from next year after Parliament in Australia votes in the social media ban bill, whatever you call it. So, William, what do you make of this now? It's actually happened. Digital IDs on the way.
Potentially, yeah. So there's several problems here. First of all, the process through which this was passed, it was a very rushed process. The Australian Senate was trying to ram through 30 bills all at once on the last sitting day of Parliament. There was no time for debate on this. And so it's a bill that takes away free speech of young people in this case. And there was no free speech involved in the debate around the bill either because the process was so truncated. So that's that thing. Secondly, it should be the choice of parents, in my view, about deciding what their kids can and can't go on. Social media is not an inherently illegitimate or dangerous thing. In the past, we've had sort of kind of moral panics about video games, about television. My dad told me they used to say the same things about books. Look at these children reading these books, getting these horrible ideas.
We've got us a reader.
Yeah, that's right. So I acknowledge that there can be harms that come from social media use, particularly around like the grooming and some of the gender stuff that happens there. There's like a social contagion effect where if...
Yeah, but they didn't talk about that. They're okay with that. They're okay with the gender.
Well, that's right.
And fluidity promotion.
That's what's so bad about this. If the government was really keen on preventing harms, it would stop teaching that in school. Maybe it would think about banning porn sites. That was another one of the things.
You can go
this won't apply to any porn site. It applies to social media.
Yeah, it doesn't cover it. And that was one of the main reasons, I think, early on, that it was sold on that. It was one of the items it was sold on.
Well, if you're aiming to prevent harm, it seems very odd that the part of the internet you would start with would be social media. Maybe there's some harms from social media, but there's a lot of good things can come from social media too. It can prevent social isolation. It can allow kids to talk to them. Some of the mental health groups in Australia actually said this. They said, well, a lot of young people are accessing mental health through social media. So if you ban them from using it, it could have negative effects. But yeah, the digital ID is another thing. In order to prevent young people from signing up, going on social media, everyone is going to have to verify their ID to say they're not under 16. And so that's probably going to require some sort of digital ID. It's not clear exactly how they're doing it because they're putting all the onus on the social media companies themselves to figure out a system for doing it. But once you have that system up and running, it's very easy to expand that to exclude people for other reasons other than age. Mm. You can exclude older people. You can exclude anyone the government knows, and the government can talk to the social media companies and say, well, we don't want that person going on there. He's saying things we don't like. So it can be very easily expanded to censor pretty much a lot of parts of the internet, censor dissidents that the government doesn't like from using them or going on them or using them to spread their message. And that's really the real worry. Another problem is around anonymity. So anonymous social media accounts have been a great thing for free speech because of the way people are silenced is that they find out who you are and then they bring personal costs to bear against you. They try and get you fired. They try and hurt your reputation. They try and make you unemployable, these sorts of things. And if it's an anonymous account, then they can't do that. So anonymous accounts have had a huge benefit in getting unpopular truths out into the public domain. And that's at risk if you have to verify your identity in order to create an account and go online. So that's another aspect that I think is important here.
In terms of digital ID, you put it on the – here's a scenario. You put it on the social media company platforms, giants, whatever you want to call them. They say, no, we're not going to do that. Then you say, okay, we're going to have to do it. And then you've got what you want if you want a digital ID that people are really worried about.
Well, one of the insidious things here is that they're saying that the social media companies themselves have to design a system to exclude the young people. So they're going to get the tech companies to design the digital ID system and logon system. And then once they've done that, of course, I think that the governments would love to appropriate something like that and use it for their own purposes for whatever they want. So that's I think that's the
reason. And then I've got to prove that I'm not under 16. That's even right. Though I'm 61, which is exactly the opposite, funnily enough. So you can see how the tentacles of it can move out. Do you think that had anything to do with the rush through? Because the other mis and disinformation bill crashed and burned And that could have been an on-ramp to digital ID as well. So you just flip horses. If the goal is the same, now push this one because we can get the same result ultimately. Do you think there's anything in that?
Totally. And I think that, you know, you disguise it in the bill that's all about helping children, but that's really got nothing to do with it all. It was just a Trojan horse to implement digital ID so they can monitor and control Australian citizens.
Helen?
Okay. So I understand your concerns about the free speech, William. However, as the teacher talking and a different generation, our socialising was pretty good without the internet way back in the ancient days. And, you know, I would look at this more as the health, and I think the harm is actually bigger than we can even discuss on this show. I mean, you talked about grooming and the influences and, you know, those, that child exploitation, I think is actually a really big conversation that we need. And whether that is around this banning, I would have been in favour of something similar to this, but I think it needs to be bigger than that because we do have a lot of issues with the addictiveness of screen time, for example. And let's face it, if the kids weren't being able to access things like TikTok and the social media, I don't think they'd be on the screen time for as long.
Do you think that will stop them? Come on. They'll find a way.
Do I think it would stop them?
They'll find a way.
What else are they going to go on if they can't go on screen time? Like,
well, anyone can. I'm
a mum of boys, and they spend a lot of time in their. I shouldn't talk about my boys, but in their bedrooms on the gaming, but it wasn't social media, and so I accept that, you know, there's a stage that our younger generation go through when they're gaming, but, you know, largely it's the girls now,
boys,
that are on these social media apps, and the influence around these perverts, you know, the predators out there is massive.
Yeah, but isn't it the responsibility, sorry to jump in, but, you know, who's the parent here? Who's responsibility? The Prime Minister, do you want Albo to be the parent? Seriously?
No, absolutely not. I think I agree that there needs to be something kind of different happening here. What that is a bigger conversation. You know, there's so much to talk about the developing brains of young people and how this addictive, you talk about parents, look at parents. Half of them are on their phone the whole time. No wonder, you know, that's the role modelling that they're having.
Well, they need to get their crap together.
Well, really, are we here to tell parents? I mean, I don't know. This is a societal issue, I believe. 10, 15 years ago when I was teaching, before I was in the senior school, when I was teaching juniors, you know, I had a parent come to me, and I've talked about this before, and she said she didn't know how to get her child off the iPad. You know, he wasn't able to learn in the classroom because his brain was so wired all the time from being on the iPad. And, you know, this was a six-year-old, and I said to her, he's six. That was my response. He's six. You know, yeah, you're the parent. What are you doing in your home where you're not being able to
manage that? No iPad anymore. A few tantrums, but we get over it.
So yeah, I understand the, William, your take on this, but there's also a bigger societal issue here.
Anything more to say about this?
I don't disagree with that. Like, I can see the harm that it has on young people. But at the same time, I think it needs to be the parents' responsibility to monitor that. You know, with my kids, we had a rule, no phones in your bedroom. They never went in their bedrooms at night. Like, no computers, no phones in the bedroom. Like, parents can't make rules to protect kids, but it's just that we have so many hero parents now that don't want to, or parents that are so busy trying to juggle life that they're not paying enough attention.
Yeah, but don't sign up for parenthood. You need to consider these things.
Yeah.
You really do. Otherwise, do something else. Stay partying or something.
Stay engaged with what your children are doing and where they're going, and, you know, not be a jellyfish parent.
Yeah, but I do go back to the social media ban. I think it is a Trojan horse, and it is dangerous what they've done. And as Will has said, that it is going to extend, the tentacles will extend out and they will catch everyone, and they smashed it through without a review precisely because they didn't want people to understand its implications.
Could happen here.
Not if we don't let it happen.
Yeah, well.
I mean, Christopher Luxon has signalled that he is open to at least considering it. But, I mean, I would hope that it wouldn't happen here. I mean, I agree with Helen that the harms are real. I'm not disputing the existence of.
But there've always been harms. I used to get bullied. I've done a bit of bullying myself as a kid. You know, there's harm in. I don't know if that's more serious harm than not, but that was actually physical. So, you know, there's always been harm.
I do think it does rewire their brains quite substantially, though, doesn't it? Like that, their attention, their ability to pay attention to anything is limited to like 30-second cycles, really, isn't it?
Well, that's where you take away the device. Sorry, we have to manage your use of the device. Here's why. If you don't like it, well, too bad. It won't be long before you're so hungry you're going to want to come out of your room and eat anyway.
But I think, Paul, that even adults can't manage their use on devices. So how are they going to now implement that for their children?
Okay, so Albo's the parent then.
I do think it's a bigger societal issue. But no, anyway, it's a bigger conversation.
Okay, speaking of could it happen here, take a listen to this. Candace Owens has had her visa revoked in Australia. She's planning to come here in November. We're not like that, are we, here?
Well, the reality is you've got to be prepared to hear both sides of the story. You don't have to agree with people. You've got to hear them out. And what we've got is a circumstance where today people are saying, no one's got the right to offend me by saying things that I disagree with. This is getting totally macabre and extreme in a modern era when, as I say, we've got more chance to learn more things in a quicker time than any time in history, multiplied by many factors. But no, they don't want to hear someone else's point of view.
Is that what we would... I know you don't have to answer this because it could be a diplomatic incident, but is that what we would expect from a like country like Australia? We've been to war with Australia. We've fought for freedoms. And it's so easily just discarded there, it seems.
Well, I'm not condemning Australia because I've seen the same thing happening here. I've seen in recent times this sort of woke generation saying, oh, we can't have this person here because they might say something offensive to me. Whether it's true or not is not of any concern to them, or whether it challenges them to actually justify what they believe is not a concern to them either. So quite the converse. We're no better in that regard. And so before we start dumping down on Australia, look at our own record.
So Winston Peters on this program about 2 weeks ago. So, two sides of the story. We're not getting
as we now know. I think no government minister had any control over this decision. This was solely Immigration New Zealand, and they were using some excuse that there's a Section 15 of the Immigration Act that requires them to exclude individuals who have been excluded from Australia. Therefore, implying that they had no discretion in Candace Owens' case. But Section 15 refers to individuals who have been convicted of serious crimes with imprisonment of more than 5 years, and it's usually implied to individuals who have been deported or removed from another country.
Avi Yemeni got hit with that.
Yeah. See, so it's not the same thing. So I'm really hoping, because there has been quite a backlash on this, that Chris Pink and Erica Stanford will actually review this. Apparently, they have to have a complaint by Candace Owens before they can review it and overturn it.
Candace Owens isn't a threat to national security. She's not going to come in and blow up anything or, you know, cause any mass shootings or anything like that. She's just got ideas that certain people don't like. And so this is just using the immigration system as a tool for censorship. And I agree with Roe. The way the law is being used here is not exactly correct. And the Free Speech Union of New Zealand is looking to challenge that. So all power to them. I hope they can mount a successful legal challenge.
And yeah, like you said, William, she's not a threat to New Zealand. I mean, she's coming here with her ideas. Some of them might be wacky, but, you know, she's been described as a conservative activist. I'm a conservative activist, and I want to hear what some other, you know, other conservative people have to say. And so I have a right to listen, just like, you know, the free speech that you're talking about before. People can impart anything. It doesn't matter if it's offensive to others, it's free speech. The issue here also, as we know, the elephant in the room is the far right tag. Now, what is far right? It's basically a left-wing conspiracy theory, in my opinion. You know, they rebrand the worst socialists like Hitler as far right, and then they apply the same label to everyone they want to delegitimize. Trump as far right, Elon Musk and Jordan Peterson are far right, Posey Parker as far right. I'm far right, probably. Well, actually, I'm not, but that's what they, you know, there's a book.
You're sounding a bit far right to me, Helen.
Oh, yeah, we could have got those names out there. As
these soon as dangerous ideas.
Well, I'm in a book with a few other far-right people, so we're working on that. We'll, yeah, but it's just, it's bizarre, you know. I mean, like Rose said, I think Erica Stanford is looking into it right now. Is that the situation? I think they might overturn it? Yeah.
Yeah, well, the Free Speech Union have said they're going to take a legal action against the Crown if it isn't overturned, so hopefully they will. But, you know, we've got these, I think it was Young Labour that originally kicked up a stink about it.
Yeah.
So they obviously don't really believe in freedom of speech. And what these little idiots don't get is that while they're celebrating their win, all they've done is raise a whole lot of awareness of who Candace Owens is. And if anyone goes and has a look at her platform, she's got millions and millions of followers. I think it's over 3 million on YouTube, 6 million on X. They'll probably look at most of her stuff and go, well, I agree with her. She makes sense. And whether you agree with her views or not, she's actually a bloody highly intelligent woman that has the ability to debate with the best of them.
Oh, she can pull people apart. And that's the danger, I keep saying. This is what people
the issue is around anti-Semitism, right? So she's been accused of saying anti-Semitic comments. And in Australia, presumably, the Australian government has been lobbied by Jewish groups to prevent her from...
Same here, maybe.
...the country. Well, some of our Jewish groups, actually, I think, were advocating for her to be allowed to come in. So I think they've some in New Zealand's, Juliet Moses, perhaps, I might have...
They were for
I think they've done quite well. So I would like to acknowledge and salute what they're doing in promoting free speech.
They're big free speech advocates, which is great.
But the... it's a race to the bottom if we have a situation where everyone, where groups, if the Jewish group wants to cancel this speaker because they say something they don't like, and then, you know, a different minority, the gays, want to cancel this speaker because they say something they don't like. If every little group is cancelling speakers who say things they don't like, then we end up with a public discussion where none of the real opinions and real disagreements can ever be aired and ever be voiced. And this is, I think, the problem with the woke way of looking at things. It shuts down public discussion in order to prevent people's feelings getting hurt and people saying things people don't like. And that means you can never really have an honest public discussion. And what does democracy mean in that context, where these difficult disagreements between groups in society can never be openly discussed and debated? It means that people never really have a chance to consider the arguments and let them inform their voting decisions. So it's really a threat to democracy. This sort of woke DEI censorship regime, I don't think, is consistent with liberal democracy.
No, and going back the other way, they don't want you to hear certain things, the other side, but they're okay to keep spouting away and hitting me with everything they want to tell me about. It's all right for them. I might be offended. I might be really offended. But they don't care about me, do they?
Look, Helen was mentioning about being, you know, seen as far right these days. Pretty much, unless you're far left, you're considered far right, I think. The whole centre, everything has just shifted, hasn't it?
Well, the far right thing against Candace Owens, I think one of the sources for that idea came from the manifesto, Brenton Tarrant's manifesto.
I think it seemed like a
joke that he cited a bunch of sort of more mainstream conservative commentators, and he called them, he said that they were like his influences and radicalized them. But I think he was meaning that as kind of like a joke, or he was exaggerating. I don't think he was being honest about that, them really being his influences.
So they can't tell that nuance.
What he wanted to do was create a situation where a whole bunch of mainstream commentators were labelled far right and were attempted to be cancelled in order to bring about a final conflict between the people who want to the left wing people and the right wing people. We wanted to intensify, to accelerate the conflict, to bring it to a resolution. So I think that's probably why he was selecting people like Candace Owens and Marco Rubio and people like this,
who Secretary of State
commentators, is saying they were far right and they were his.
Well, I could imagine if let's say we were transmitting at that time and that was mentioned in a manifesto like that, then what? There'd be we're in our own country, but we'd be stopped coming into the country just by some kind of association, something that someone wrote somewhere we had absolutely no knowledge of.
Yeah, it's not a good way of running. You need to listen to what people actually say and judge their arguments on their merits, not this kind of game of association where we ban people because this person said there was an influence or...
But the other thing is, if you don't want to hear them, don't go and hear them. You know, it's really simple. You know, Candace Owens was going to be at, like, speaking at some events place out West Auckland. Like, it's not in the middle of the city. It's not going to impact anyone who doesn't want to go and hear her. So, yeah, that's the thing that frustrates me most is, you know, they go on that people are going to be hurt and harmed. Well, how if they're not there?
And what is the hurt? It's like emotional hurt, is it?
I got my feelings hurt. Feelings, it's about feelings. And then I say to that, are we responsible for everyone else's feelings? Are we? Like, what kind of, what are we putting on to our young people where we are teaching them that you have to get affirmation from everybody else that you are okay? I have a huge concerns going back to what William was talking about, how, you know, she was named in the manifesto. I and many others in New Zealand have been named in a book about people that you should fear in New Zealand, the underworld of extremists. And, you know, that's hugely concerning because you have then...
What's the book? What's the book?
Sections of society who are shunning you. I'm struggling at the moment to get employment. And anyway, you'll hear more about this.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah.
Challenge. So the book is Fear. It's called Fear, Underworld...
I think I've heard of it. Who's the author?
Byron
Clark.
Oh, yeah.
God.
Yes, Byron Clark. And so you get your name, you know, put into a book that somebody identifies or labels, starts labeling all these people. And do you know why? So I've been a teacher for almost, well, over 16 years. I was a teacher who stood up and spoke out around something that I've concerned, you know, about our children. And all of a sudden I'm being placed into this far-right extremist. So, you know, that's...
By this little dickhead. So where is he from? I've heard the name, but what's his...
Oh, he lives background? He lives in Christchurch where I am.
Oh, you might bump into him one day.
Hope so. Well, actually, he was at one of my meetings. That's where he took lots of notes.
Let's see. I wonder what happened to him to have
that.
Him all
You'll
twisted
hear more
up.
About that very soon, though, yeah. Paul.
Mummy and Daddy didn't do a good job on him.
Far left extremist that gets platformed by our mainstream media constantly.
Yeah. See, it's one way. That's my point.
Extremist.
What if he offends the hell out of me? No one's sympathetic to what I'm
celebrated on the likes of Q&A. You know, they have him on as some expert in terrorism and extremists. And he's even teaching. He went up to Auckland Massey University and is teaching a paper on it.
Oh, it just keeps getting better, doesn't it?
Another reason not to send your kids to university, right?
Yeah, manage that
his
too.
His qualification iPad. Didn't come from university. It came from Facebook stalking. That's where it began.
Right.
Anyway.
Poor boy. All right, time consideration now. But I want to get a reaction because it was big here. Rodney and I high-fived each other in the studio. It was quite a moment when we found out that the Whangarei District Council had voted against fluoridation. Kind of felt like some sort of small victory in the domino, the falling of the dominoes that will lead to, well, no more fluoride. It's a pretty ballsy thing to do, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, local democracy works, doesn't it? The issue was raised. We've discussed it on RCR several times. Gavin Benny, I think, went in and moved the motion at the Whangarei District Council. They had a debate, I think, on it, and the vote was... was the vote against fluoridation of the water? That's what it ended up.
7-6 with one abstention, I think. So,
Whangarei was one of 14 councils directed by old Ashley Bloomfield to start fluoridation, and I think they don't they face penalties of like $200,000 or $10,000 a day.
$10,000 a day after the $200K, yeah.
Good on them for pushing back, but you know the evidence is now coming out of just how bad it is. So. Now, hopefully this will create a domino effect. Is it Nelson that's next up to meet and talk about this? And then I think the Horowhenua Council. So, yeah, let's hope
and
it does.
And Tauranga, well.
Yeah, but there needs to be some accountability somewhere along the line. Will that ever happen?
There's the questions about whether the order that the Director General of Health issued that these councils to do this, it's legal and in line with the Bill of Rights. So that's something that ought to be... So while we should do this council by council, it also that order also needs to be questioned at some level.
Yeah.
But
and what the Ministry of Health is going to do about it as well, right? Because this is their order. You know, what do they do?
Well, they have to explain why they've been fluoridating the water system and poisoning people for all this time. Talking about message management, right? They've got to get ahead of that one first before they can sort of ease up, I'm picking. How would you do that? With sorry?
Will they even bother? I don't know. I mean, they're still promoting the COVID jab, aren't they?
Yeah,
I was watching
a
YouTube video yesterday and promoting it to everyone aged 6 months and over. God, when will it end?
There's an important sort of philosophical battle here between, like, public health, a lot of people involved in public health who want to be able to do these broad sweeping public health measures for pandemics, but also for water, also for other reasons, that they put folate in the bread. And there's a question whether that's consistent with the Bill of Rights, with mass medication of people.
Well, how could it be?
Consistent. So this is a quite an interesting and important philosophical divide in our society, that has the sort of public health people who want to do these big interventions pitted against the people who defend individual rights.
Especially when there are alternatives to not mass medicating like that in a public water supply. But they can't, the power isn't there for them in that though, is it?
Yeah, well, I mean, is it an individual's responsibility, or is it sometimes a warranted for the government to...
No, I think it's the government's responsibility, William, to lower the IQ of children.
No, not in this case. I think it's very clear in this case now that the evidence has come out about the harms that fluoride causes. But in some of these other areas, like where there might not necessarily be evidence of harms at this point.
Like folate in the bread, synthetic folate.
Yeah, yeah. What is that legitimate or not? This is the sort of philosophical debate that underlies it.
All right, coming up on time, some final comments on anything we've been talking about or specifically this.
I'd just like to say, you know, in terms of undermining trust in our health system, like, you know, whether we're talking about the fluoride, we're talking about the COVID jab, or even the puberty blockers, which they now acknowledge they have poor evidence of, you know, of them being any good, but they're still going to continue prescribing them. It all just undermines...
No, forcing them to only affirmation.
Yes, well, they're only, but they're also pushing the liability for them onto the doctors prescribing them. So they're saying, well, look, we know that there's no evidence that they're good and there may be harms, but we're going to push any liability away from us onto doctors. Like, it's just, how do you have trust in a public health system that does this?
Well, don't they do, like, with the same with the fluoride and anything that the Ministry of Health are putting out? They put out these guidelines. So it's, you know, where have you heard that before? Even with the education, sexuality, it's guidelines. And I think it's so that they don't have to have accountability, because when you go back and inquire or question, they just pass a buck. Like the Minister of Education, the Teaching Council, when we had to challenge, we were challenged about these guidelines, she just kept putting it back to, well, they are guidelines. We're not, you know, this is not mandated.
How slimy is that?
These prescribing puberty blockers, it's the position statement from the Ministry of Health allows those who have been providing the gender affirming care to continue with their normal practices. I mean, what does this statement mean to you? Clinicians should exercise caution in prescribing. What does that even mean?
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you know,
I was disappointed in the puberty blockers decision. I thought that, I mean, the evidence brief that had some nods towards the harms that can come from, the use of puberty blockers in kids. But in terms of the position statement that's been outlined, all it does is say exercise caution. It doesn't really change anything materially in terms of the rules that doctors have to work under. And I think that given what we know now, given some of the horrific things that have come out around the use of puberty blockers, it's not acceptable.
Well, no, it's worse than that, the way I see it, William, because only those involved in the affirmation part of the therapy are to be now consulted, which means actually market share has increased for the nutters. So it's actually worse.
Mm. Yeah, it's like asking the fox for advice on how to control or how to guard the chickens, right?
Do you think they laugh while they say these things to themselves?
I don't know. But I think what it shows is just our bureaucracy is so captured by ideology, isn't it?
Well, that's one of the things, I mean, having worked in the government, when you put advice up, there's sort of a requirement or an expectation that you go and talk to every little group within the government who has a different view, and you've got to provide a sort of holistic advice that takes into account all the different views. And sometimes that's good, but sometimes that's bad because it means you can never really have a fight between one view being really wrong. You have to try and please all parties. So not all questions are like that. I can see why in a democracy you want to have a consensus that appeals to everyone, but sometimes some groups are just wrong about things and they need to
not when it's mutilating children.
That's right, yeah.
No
but
way.
They've got it clear in this position statement that they've said the quality of the evidence is low with a high risk of bias. So they're talking about poor studies, and this weird thing about it is that now saying that New Zealand needs to have a specific research into understanding New Zealand adolescents. Well, what is different for New Zealand adolescents than all these other countries who have banned it? It's not specific.
We're special.
But the other thing is that they've been reviewing this for the last 2 years. Why weren't they doing this study over the last 2 years while they were reviewing it?
Well, what is even reviewing?
That's where I'm a bit concerned about the New Zealand First, who are celebrating that they're getting something done about this puberty blockers. I put a petition out over a year ago to ban puberty blockers. Now, I reached out to a New Zealand First MP earlier this year to have it tabled to the House. And, you know, while she did acknowledge my request, I then heard nothing further. That was an opportune moment to open up the conversation then and actually get it to the Select Committee.
Because there's nothing to lose, right? There's nothing to lose politically. There's only everything to win, is the way I see it.
Just before voting time.
Yeah, maybe timing's everything.
We can dance about it then. Yeah.
All right, speaking of timing, we're up against time. I want to thank for joining our panel this morning. Helen Halton, thanks, Helen, for coming in. Sorry about the link earlier. William McGibsey and Roe Edge, thanks for coming in, folks. Really interesting.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks. It's good.
Thanks, Paul.
Have a great weekend. All right, that's our political panel. If you've got anything to say about that, you can text or email 2057 or inbox at realitycheck.radio.
Hi, Peter Williams here. Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email or hit the join email button on your RCR app.